Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Who would agree to stand at attention for hours in their underwear, to be yelled at, cursed at, smeared with foul substances, forced to drink alcohol beyond blackout drunk, endure other forms of ritual humiliation, sexual assault, and physical torture? Oh, that and all of it, it could result in the loss of a life, and sometimes it has. This is hazing. These are some of the more common hazing-related activities reported in student groups. And now there is a new law, an effort to crack down on hazing, armed with this new Texas law. What is that law? How does it work? And what do you need to understand about hazing to understand that this is dangerous? Call in with your questions and comments. The number is 210-614-8980. Did you go through some form of hazing? What was it like? What was that story? Do you want to share it with us? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet at us at @tprsource. We're joined this hour by Debbie DeBrick. She is a member of the Anti-Hazing Coalition and advocated for the anti-hazing legislation. Debbie DeBrick, welcome to The Source.
Good morning or good afternoon.
It's good to have you. Chris Quintana is with us, an education enterprise reporter for USA Today. Chris?
Hi. How you doing today?
Doing good. Good to have you. Elizabeth Allen joins us as a professor, program coordinator for the Higher Education Graduate Program at University of Maine and has studied hazing. Elizabeth Allen, welcome to The Source.
Hi. Thanks for including me.
And also with us, Judson Horace, president and CEO of the North American Interfraternity Conference, and he also worked to help bring about the bill. That bill is ASB 38. And Judson Horace, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me.
So, Judson, can you tell me more about this bill, SB 38?
Yeah, we spent quite a bit of time in the last Texas legislature getting what was already a pretty good Texas law strengthened thanks to the leadership of Senator Zaffirini, and frankly, Debbie played a huge role, as well as the Cumberland family. We were able to get a stronger bill. Specifically, we got some stronger language around making it a felony to force or coerce the consumption of alcohol in the hazing. That's often leading to a lot of these deaths that you read about nationally, so it's one of the key goals of our coalition is state by state. We're trying to strengthen hazing laws. Some other key provisions is making sure that there was a medical Good Samaritan policy where these students are injured. There isn't a pause to call for help. There's an immediate calling of 911 and giving the people that seek the assistance limited immunity, but that's still an important ingredient. But all in all, we saw it as a victory to start with. I'm actually going to be back in Austin, Texas next week, February 11th, testifying before the Higher Education Committee, talking about how we should implement the bill throughout the state, and then also how we could strengthen it in future sessions.
Okay. So this bill, it really does need public awareness, and that's our mission today is to raise awareness of this bill and what it does. Debbie DeBrick, you were instrumental in fighting for this anti-hazing legislation, and I hate to have to ask you to tell us about, you know, why you are so passionate about getting this bill passed. I know that this touched you personally.
Yes, sir. In August of 2014, we had moved my son Dalton to his dorm at Texas Tech, August 16th, just 2 days before he turned 18. And on August 18th, on his 18th birthday, he started rushing for Texas Tech. And a week later, on August 24th, Dalton's lost his life. We were back in Lubbock, and it was due to alcohol-induced relay games that happened on his midnight that night. And after the shock of all this had worn off, we decided as a family that we would adequately work and save lives, and we didn't want any other parent to go through this. So that is our reasoning for pushing for the new law. And what we found with Dalton and his case is, unfortunately, the current law that was in place did not have enough teeth, and there was a lot of gray areas, and nobody would prosecute under the law the way it was written. With that being said, six individuals that were responsible for Dalton's death, their charges were reduced to providing alcohol to a minor, and they served 100 hours community service and paid a $200 fine for his death.
So it seems like there wasn't a lot of accountability with what happened to your son.
Exactly. There was not.
How would that change under the new law?
Under the new law, it's expanding the definition of hazing. It's now defined as involving coercing a student to consume a drug, alcohol, or beverage or liquor in the amount that would lead a reasonable person to believe that the student is intoxicated. And that is a little bit of the gray area of where the hazing law was. It didn't define that. And also with the new law, there's some transparency with the reporting that the university has to do. And I think as a parent, we probably would have researched more and been more aware of what is happening on those nights, and maybe had more talks with our son in regards to hazing and the binge drinking with hazing and what could possibly happen on a bid night and prevented his death.
And do you think the university was responsible, could have been more active in trying to prevent these types of activities?
I think what they had in place, they thought that they had the right tools and the right people in place. As far as the university, they were obviously not aware of everything going on in the fraternities and sororities and other student activities as they are now. But there's a lot more awareness of what can happen when these types of events happen. And there's a lot of things happening at the national level as far as banning the hard liquor in these events. And that is ultimately what killed my son, as he drank half a handle of whiskey in one drink.
Was he taken to a hospital? Did he get medical care that night?
No. He was not taken to the hospital. Within an hour, he was unresponsive. This was by 8 o'clock at night, and he was dragged into the house and then later loaded in a car. They were going to go put him in his dorm. He's still unresponsive at this time. There was police there, so they came back to the house and took him back in the house and laid him on a floor, unresponsive. Lubbock PD was on site at midnight due to a complaint called in about the drinking from a neighbor, and they just had all the minors go inside or get a ride home and didn't check the residents, or they would have found my child and possibly saved him. Dalton passed away somewhere around midnight to 1 o'clock, and 911 wasn't called till 8 o'clock the next morning.
Okay, so that's an important part of this new law, giving the people an opportunity to call law enforcement, to call EMS, to bring medical care, and they will not suffer heavy consequences. That's a big part of what we want to talk about and what we want to promote in our conversation this afternoon. The number is 210-614-8980. We'll be right back. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies, and we're talking about hazing. It happens in high schools. It happens in colleges. It happens with fraternities and sports teams and other student groups. Why does it happen? And there can be fatal consequences. What are some of the laws that are now in place trying to provide some protections, some sort of way to keep these things from getting out of hand. Have you ever gone through a hazing activity? Were you ever pledged at a fraternity or sorority in college? Was hazing involved? Was it physical, psychological, harmful? What do you consider to be hazing? We want to hear your story. You can be anonymous. The number is 210-614-8980. Elizabeth Allen's professor and program coordinator with the Higher Education Graduate Program at the University of Maine, and you've done a lot of research and focused on student hazing and the climate that allows these things to happen. What do you hear when you hear the story that we heard from Debbie DeBrick?
Well, first I want to thank Debbie for sharing her story and other parents who have endured this nightmare of losing a child to hazing, for their strength in working to promote awareness and prevent tragedies like this from happening. What I hear in her story is a number of aspects that are common to other stories that ended in tragedy. And I will say that these are the ones that we tend to hear the most about. But hazing covers a full spectrum of behaviors, including intimidation behaviors, harassment behaviors, and then the most extreme behaviors, which can often be lethal. And so it's important to keep in mind that there are many opportunities for prevention, and there are opportunities when things are very serious to intervene and disrupt what's happening in terms of these really dangerous, high-risk behaviors with the potential for alcohol poisoning, and also having the immunity so that students aren't fearful of reporting to authorities and calling an ambulance sooner than they do often. So those things are all important, but we also have to look at turning our attention and some additional resources to primary prevention, which is stopping the behavior before it even begins.
What does that look like?
Well, what we're learning and from the research and other prevention arenas, and we're borrowing from fields where there has been a lot more research conducted. You know, for example, in suicide prevention, bullying prevention, and so forth, high-risk drinking prevention. We know that in order to prevent the behavior before it begins, we have to have a more like a comprehensive approach where policy and legislation is a key component. But we also have to look at, for example, in this case with hazing, we have to really improve the literacy around hazing. We have a very low level of general understanding about what it is, what the risks are, when a kind of behavior crosses the line into hazing, and how it can be, how students and others who might be bystanders can intervene. And so I guess, in short, we need to really learn a lot more, but also we know enough to know that this is going to take a comprehensive approach where we have, campuses and, this also happens in high schools. So we need to be looking beyond, colleges and universities as well to educate the general public about hazing, educate students, teachers, coaches, those who work with students and their student organizations, faculty, about what hazing is. And then we also, and we can do that through trainings, we can do that through peer education, policies, social marketing campaigns. There are many ways that we can improve the literacy around hazing. And we can also help to prevent hazing by building skills for bystander intervention, by having more transparency, and that's what's great about the new law in Texas and other laws as well, where they're promoting, where they're requiring colleges and universities to report and be public about the violations that have occurred so that students and their families can do some research and find out what's happened in these organizations that they're considering joining. So transparency is really important, as well as leadership commitment and visible messaging from leaders of colleges and universities, students, administrators, and others who are, you know, willing to be very public about this kind of behavior not aligning with the missions and values of higher education.
Chris Quintana, he is a education enterprise reporter for USA Today. He's been covering hazing. And Chris, you write that every year since, 1959, we've had at least one hazing death in America. Almost like clockwork, we know that someone is going to die due to hazing every year.
That is true. That is based on this academic Hank Neuer's list that he keeps up of hazing deaths. He tracks them every year. It's also, if you spend enough time kind of covering higher education, you can kind of anticipate it as well. It's usually in the fall. People that I've talked with who have also been affected by losing their children to hazing also kind of have said similar things to me, where they said, at the start of every semester, we can feel it. Like, we know it's going to happen again. And that's kind of a weird and awful place for them to be, because they want to try and prevent it from happening again, but have been so far unable to prevent it.
And this last November was especially deadly, wasn't it?
This last November? Yeah. So there was a period in time where it looked like there were several deaths connected to hazing and potentially fraternities. I think more information has come out where not all of them have. There was some connection, but I think there's been some question about how the role of hazing involved there. But I think, the people who follow this say that it's been kind of at a steady pace since 2017, which was a particularly bad year. And that's the year that Timothy Piazza died. And I think that kind of re-galvanized the national conversation about it in a way that hadn't been done before, just because of how vivid the details were coming out of it and how tragic the whole situation was.
So how do we make that connection then? This is hazing or not hazing, Chris, with a fatal incident with a student. They were driving and they crashed their vehicle and they died. It wasn't directly related to hazing, but they've been kept awake for 48 hours by an activity and had a lot to drink or whatever. Is that considered a hazing-related death?
I think that's a question families are trying to ask themselves and trying to get resolved through the courts, right? I mean, that is something that comes up often, and I think there's often a challenge in getting all the information involved kind of with what happened. I've spoken with a mother who lost her child to hazing, and she remarked to me that one of the challenges was that she couldn't find any information from any of the young men who knew her son. So I think that's particularly challenging. And I think when you don't have all the information, that can make it harder to make that distinction, right? So I think that's part of the challenge that we deal with when these things tend to be kind of veiled in secrecy.
So Debrick, when Dalton, his life was lost, did the fraternity, were they transparent? Did they explain to you what had happened, or was there a wall of silence that met you when you tried to find out?
No, the fraternity was 100% transparent. They actually shut down the chapter there at Texas Tech within 48 hours themselves before the university had a chance to. So they, since day one, they have been very supportive of us, and they have recognized it as hazing since day one. And Alpha Sigma has been just unbelievably supportive.
Judson Horace, you're the president and CEO of the North American Interfraternity Conference. So tell me, so you work with a lot of fraternities? Is that what you do?
Yeah, we represent approximately 4,000, undergraduate chapters, about a quarter of a million fraternity men at any given time, and 65 international organizations. So quite a large footprint across North America.
Okay, so do you have some sort of like, I mean, to me, it seems like everyone should know that if you force someone to drink half a bottle of bourbon or whatever, that they're going to have alcohol poisoning and other things that happen with these hazing things are dangerous. And so, I mean, is there a way that your organization working with these frats and sort of like, well, these are some activities that you can do to probably accomplish what you're trying to achieve, which is build some sort of unity in the spirit of the core or whatever it is that hazing is supposed to accomplish without being so dangerous?
Yeah, absolutely. So we, you know, just for context about the problem of hazing in North America, the main study, which Dr. Allen's a part of and other studies, pretty good evidence that 50% of incoming freshmen have experienced some form of hazing in high school and middle school before they even arrive on a college campus, right? And for more context, when you look at college higher education, most of the information is we had 1,800 related injuries and 1,800 deaths last year alone and alcohol-related injuries on college campuses. So we have a culture where they're coming into the campus predisposed to hazing, and then we've got campus cultures that are very high substance abuse, and that goes for fraternities, sororities, athletic teams, band, you name it, right? So these are large, complex societal issues. One of the ways we're trying to get at this is similar to like what the MAD efforts did in the 80s, which is we're partnering with parents who want to work with us. We're partnering with campuses who want to work with us. We're partnering now at the federal legislative level and at the local state level, trying to strengthen policy around laws. We're trying to strengthen awareness. These parents, Debbie, the Piazzas, the Groovers, many others, have spoken to over 135,000 college students in the past 12 months alone. So they're flying all over the country, speaking anywhere they can to college students to talk about the issues of hazing. And then on the backside, we know from the research that Dr. Allen did at Maine, we know that the students report the number one thing they think will be a deterrent to hazing is strong, visible policy and legal enforcement of laws and showing ramifications of what happens when you do this behavior, which is why we're working so hard to get these federal and state laws passed. So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, and it's not just about telling students not to do it. It's looking at the complex system and then try to figure out how we put together a coalition to get at this problem, which exists beyond fraternities. It's all over the place, and you can't just isolate it to one type of organization. Otherwise, you miss the bigger issue.
So, Judson, it sounds like you're saying that there is an awareness that happens at a frat house or something. You know, you have responsible individuals in charge of these facilities and who are saying, this is going to get us shut down, guys. You need to dial it back.
One of the unfortunate common elements that you're going to find if you read the indictments and you look at all these tragedies is a lot of these students know it's wrong and they don't want to participate. They don't want it to go on to the grand jury. But there's usually 3 to 5 ringleaders that really push it and take it to a dangerous level. So if you go back and read the Piazza situation indictment, you go back and read the Groover indictment and others, it usually involves an extreme form of aggressive bullying behavior, which is, again, why our laws are designed for those types of people. That's a felony. You're going to jail for a long time. Whether that new member wanted to do it or not, that's not an excuse. And the second piece is strengthening the bystander intervention, which Dr. Allen was talking about. How do we help students stand up to these bullying behaviors within the group? And I'm not talking about the new members. I'm talking about all of the students watching it happen. It's like a multi-layered approach we got to do here. There are hundreds of thousands of college fraternity men that don't want this behavior going on. They get tired of these people taking it to extremes. Mm-hmm. They get tired of being labeled all as one. And so that's why we're taking such an aggressive stand on this.
All right. We're going to take a break. Our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980. Have you gone through hazing? I did. I can tell you about it when we come back from the break, but it was rough, and I still kind of feel some of the damage from it. And what was it like for you? Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this.
Border walls, restrictions on refugees. It's not easy to seek protections in the U.S.
How desperate do you think a person has to be to leave all their belongings, things they know, the language they know, the culture they know, the life they know, risk their life to get here?
Next time on Fronteras, Haroon Moniz shares his refugee story. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about hazing and how dangerous it can be and how this happens all the time. Every year we see at least one fatality on a college campus connected to hazing and why this has been so difficult to dial back. We do have a new state law in Texas, went into effect in September. This does increase the penalties, makes more individuals responsible, also creates a way so that people can report hazing, get medical attention for someone without having to deal with some sort of legal consequences. We're going to hear more about that. We got an email from Susan. My daughter was a student at Cornell University nearly two decades ago and told us of a fraternity that had been kicked off of campus for a hazing misconduct. The event in question involved a pledge being chained naked in the fraternity's front yard at the beginning of the year, and it was very cold, and he was supposed to bark at passersby. The number is 210-614-8980. Have you gone through hazing? What was that like? What are your memories of that? I mean, I was a student at University of Texas at Austin. I had joined a fraternity, and a lot of these things that we're talking about right now, about standing at attention for hours in your underwear, being yelled at, cursed at, smeared with foul substances, forced to drink alcohol beyond, you know, what is reasonable, other forms of humiliation and torture. Yeah, I went through all that, and I had no idea why I was doing it when I was doing it. I couldn't tell you. And I do feel like I was psychologically damaged for going through that experience. And I wouldn't recommend it for anyone. I would tell anyone, don't do that. It is not good for you. I don't know what they're trying to, how they coerced me into doing that, but I went along with it. And I have no idea why. And the number is 210-614-8980. Elizabeth Allen, professor, program coordinator for the Higher Education Graduate Program at the University of Maine. You've studied this. Why do people allow themselves to go through these horrible experiences?
Yes, and thank you for sharing your experience, because that really resonates with what I think many people experience and continue to experience. And in our research, we ask students, so, you know, why did you participate in hazing? And, you know, I think again, there isn't a single answer to this, just like there isn't a one-size-fits-all approach to prevention. There are different motivations for different people. And but I think, you know, some of the common themes, of course, are that there, you know, every human being has a strong desire to be a part of something, to belong, you know, and when you're coming into college and often you're needing to make new friends and find your place and feel that sense of belonging in a new community, if there's an organization that has expressed an interest in having you become a member, then you are, you know, inclined to want to go, to potentially go along. And so in a hazing situation, there's that, you know, intense desire for someone to want to belong and be a part of a group that, you know, can sometimes impede judgment. And at the same time, you have students who have participated in hazing, or you have some kinds of behaviors that meet the definition of hazing, that are certainly hazing, that have been seen as quote-unquote traditions for, or they are perceived to be traditions that have occurred throughout the years, although sometimes that's not the case. But there's a sense of, often students talk about, you know, this wasn't hazing. This was, they minimize it and they rationalize it by using euphemisms like, this wasn't hazing, that was just a tradition, or that was just an initiation, or that was just a rite of passage. So that's where I'm you know, when I spoke before, saying we need more literacy around hazing, that we really need to do that in order to disrupt this normalization of hazing, and also to do it early, so that students in middle school and high school are learning about this and are more prepared to see it when it's happening, and to have a lens, you know, where they can identify it and say, you know, I don't need to go along with this, and this doesn't need to be normal, and there are other ways that we can have a tradition and build group unity and cohesion on our team or in our club or organization. So, so I think that's a very common theme, and often, you know, students aren't intending for harm to occur, but they're participating in organizing the hazing because this is what was done to them, and so they perceive that it's something that needs to continue, or they haven't thought about another way to accomplish the positive goals they're trying to achieve.
I'm going to go to the phone lines, 210-614-8980. Don has called in. Don, thanks for calling in here on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, you're welcome. I just had a question. I wonder if this hazing law will apply to the military, because in a military training, especially basic training, hazing is a way of life, and it's been going on for years. And also, I just want to tell you that I listen to your program all the time for several years, and we really enjoy it and learn from it. And thank you.
Thank you for your great call, Don. Thanks for calling in. Let me ask you, Debbie DeBrick, if you could tell us about, you know, does this apply to the military? I don't think it really does, because the military has their own codes and military justice, but what are your thoughts?
It does not apply to the military, but I will say that we spoke in 2018 at Texas A&M, where my son was a student there. My other youngest son was a student there. And I asked if I could address the Corps there, because we know how large the Corps is there at Texas A&M, because they do go by the military standards there. And I was told absolutely address them. And so I was very vocal in my speech at Texas A&M to let the Corps know that what they are doing as well is hazing. Of course, as they are at Texas A&M, they fall under the law, but if they go on and join the military, it does not, the law does not follow them there.
The law defines hazing as any type of physical brutality, such as whipping, beating, hitting, branding, electric shocking, placing of harmful substances on the body, or any other similar activities, any type of sleep deprivation, exposure to the elements, or confinement of the subjects of a student to harm or affects their mental or physical health, any activity that includes coercing the student to consume an alcoholic beverage, liquor, or drug, and or any activity that would intimidate or threaten a student that they would be ostracized if they didn't engage in the activity, and even if they give them reason to believe that they would be kicked out of an organization. So, Judson Horace, you're with the North American Interfraternity Conference. This list seems pretty comprehensive. You think this covers it?
Yeah, I was a part of actually writing the definition to make sure that we didn't have loopholes. And in the case of Debbie's son, Dalton, it wasn't written properly. So totally supportive of the language. Matter of fact, to help craft it.
Okay, another caller. This is Matthew. Matthew, thanks for calling into The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. Wanted to share a difference in experiences from high school versus college. We have the same education in both settings. In high school for varsity sports here in San Antonio, if you made it as an underclassman, you'd be, you know, forced into drinking alcohol, or on the bus ride home, if you had a good performance, would kind of be punched and messed up with by upperclassmen. And so I was expecting a similar experience going on to college, but rushing for a fraternity there, it was totally different. We wouldn't even be allowed to pick up trash after a party. So my takeaway from the experience was the student leadership, even with having the same education, it just took one class of leaders to say hazing wouldn't go on, and that was my takeaway from the experience, and really appreciate you all talking about this on the air.
All right, Matthew, thank you for calling in. Let's go to another caller. This is Warren. Warren, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hey, Warren.
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate the comments about how much it takes place before you get to college. I experienced it 4-H in high school. And there was another incident that just happened a few years ago regarding a football team, Laverne High School. So it's pretty embedded in the students before they get to college level. And also, just a real quick comment about how you can actually haze with social media nowadays. And it's not a physical form, but it's a very potent psychological form of hazing that takes place a lot with the high school kids especially.
So, how does social media work on that? What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, you can easily be harassed through social media. It takes place all the time with high school kids.
Okay, I hear that. And Chris Quintana, you're with the USA Today reporter. Have you seen social media playing a role in this? Because you noticed that there's been an uptick in hazing fatalities and serious injuries. Do you think social media plays a role in that?
I'm a little hesitant to say for sure one way or another. I think for without a doubt that people can pile on social media and that can be a tool for harassment. I haven't seen the exact ways that like comes out, but I it wouldn't surprise me if that was the case.
We've seen also social media being a way to actually track hazing, because a lot of the events that happen end up being reported. You know, people put it on their Facebook or their Instagram or whatever they're using at the time, and there are videos that are shot of these types of abuse, there's ritualized abuse, and it gets put online, and people are very proud of it, not really actually realizing that this is evidence of them breaking the law, and that can be used to try to shut that down. And people have a responsibility, if you see that in your social media sphere, is to share that with authorities. And of course, under the new law, that you will have some immunity. The number to call in if you want to comment, got a question about hazing, how does this happen, how has it impacted you and your family, 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source is going to be back in 1 minute. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about hazing, the dangers of hazing, a new state law that went into effect. It defines what constitutes hazing and outlines what schools have to do when students participate in it. There's also an immunity for students who voluntarily report a hazing incident, and that could save someone's life. Chris Quintana, back to you, USA Today Education Enterprise reporter. What happens when these fraternities go underground? They've been banned, but yet somehow they still kind of exist on campus. What's that all about?
Yeah, so there's actually an interesting case that I was able to track down at Cooley College up in Maine. They had Greek life, right? And so what they found is that there were secret fraternities, and what ended up happening is a lot of the students would actually accuse each other of being in, of having a connection to these fraternities or being in them themselves, and there was kind of like a weird air of paranoia around. So it was a little harder for them to track, but I think the overall number, they only had a few groups, and so it has the potential to remain on campus even if you say it's banned on campus, right? And that's a concern for people, and it can be harder to track that activity if you're not tracking it officially. So
okay.
I think that's a concern that comes up often.
Judson Horace, you're the president and CEO of the North American Interfraternity Conference. What happens when you have these underground fraternities? And clearly, I guess they don't interact with you, do they?
No, I mean, so you asked about social media. The reality is today students will assemble themselves through social media, whether they're sanctioned or not, you know. And so what we have to do is certainly draw boundaries, hold students accountable, hold organizations accountable. If they're doing this hazing, We don't want them involved. We don't want to have anything to do with them. We want to make sure that students who do follow the rules have a great experience. The challenge, though, with all this technology is they can organize themselves in ways that is just so much more proficient than ever before. So that's where I think an important piece, I go back to the state laws, and then, frankly, it's not enough for a school to shut down a chapter, right, and shut down an organization. They need to individually discipline, and if they are doing these hazing behaviors, which is breaking their code of conduct, they need to be expelled from that school. That's one way that you stop the behavior, not just shutting down a fraternity or shutting down the band or shutting down the chess club. Expel students from school. And second of all, they need to turn over these cases to the local district attorney, and they need to prosecute these cases, because those are surefire ways that these underground groups that are breaking the rules no longer exist.
Debbie DeBrick, you've lost your son through hazing, and now you are an advocate for anti-hazing activities and legislation. Do you think the message is getting through? I'm seeing like some people can just all say, well, these are the fatalities are so rare. These are instances where things went wrong, you know, but you mean that's not going to happen here.
I think the message is getting through, and I think that there's a lot more awareness now. Back when Dalton passed away in 2014, he was actually one of five that particular year. There was a huge outbreak that year as well. And it was new to us as parents, and it was new to our community of the problem that is actually out there as far as the hazing. And now when you have that discussion, after our efforts at the state level, the federal level, and going cross country and speaking to all these university campuses and colleges, when you start talking about hazing, you know, in the airport or on a trip, people know now. They're like, oh yeah, I heard about that, you know. But if you would have said that, you know, even 6-7 years ago, it was very rare, you know, very rare. But now it's a common thing. It's a dinner time, dinner round table conversation with families. So I think we are reaching people, but there's only so many of us, and that's why we are pushing for this federal law is so that everybody is protected across the U.S. And Elizabeth can confirm this, but we still have a few states that don't even have a hazing law, and we have spoken to as many people as we can, and like Judd said, over 100,000 in the past 12 months. And you know, we're scheduled next week, we're scheduled this week, but there's only so many people we can touch. So I think if we do this at a federal level, and prosecutions happen like they did in the Max Gruber case, that it'll be more of awareness of what's going on. In Dalton's case, like you said, social media plays a big part in this. Dalton videotaped what he was having to do and said what he was having to do in a text to his best friend, and that still didn't get prosecuted. So I think in today's world, and with today's law that's in place in Texas, we would definitely see people serving jail time and not just getting suspended or expelled from Texas Tech and doing community service. So I think between 2014 and 2020, there's been huge, huge progress because it is a known thing. When you speak to teenagers, they know about it now.
It was in October that at the federal level, the End All Hazing Act was introduced. Elizabeth Allen, what does that do, and where is it getting? Is it going to become law, you think?
Well, great question. I know there are a lot of folks who are supporting it and supporting. There are actually two federal bills, the End All Hazing Act and the REACH Act. Both are, you know, have co-sponsors and are seeking, mm-hmm. you know, similar outcomes in terms of increasing transparency around hazing, promoting more awareness. The REACH Act includes a definition of hazing and also mandates educational programming on hazing. But, you know, I think those of us who have been working on this issue and who have experienced it personally are really looking closely at what's happening. And
okay.
And
I want to get this email on the air from Alexander. My personal experience with hazing has had lasting effects. I've struggled with depression and anxiety, among other psychological disorders. It has seriously inhibited my growth and development socially and mentally. And I don't think this, Alexander, thank you so much for this email. I don't think this gets talked about enough. So Elizabeth Allen, if you could tell me, and I only have a couple more minutes left here, this part of the conversation, you know, you go through this horrific experience and you may spend the rest of your life like I have, like wondering, why did I do that? And what was pretty horrible? And you have to kind of, it leaves marks on your mind.
Absolutely. And I hope the person who wrote in or called in knows they are not alone in those kinds of experiences. We hear that frequently. We often call that the hidden harm of hazing. When you don't see the physical scars, there are often emotional and psychic scars that can endure for years. And those who have experienced it often blame themselves. And, that sort of just compounds and amplifies the harm that occurred. So we need a lot more understanding around that and support for those who have experienced all kinds of harm from hazing.
Debbie DeBrick, if you could tell us, what have people told you about their own experiences or other parents who have lost children to this? What are they saying?
You know, the other parents who have lost children to this are actually probably the people that I talk to most in my life now. They're the closest that I know. And it's like hearing your own child's story over and over again. When I talked to Evelyn and talked to, Rayanne Groover, it's the same thing over and over again. We feel like we're in the same story, like our boys went through the same thing. As far as actual fraternity members, last summer I was able to speak at two fraternity conferences, summer conferences in Denver and Phoenix. And I had so many current fraternity members come speak to me, and tell me about their hazing issues and what they've gone through and what they know about and what they've seen. And it's heartbreaking. I can't even explain it. When you just read that email, I choked up because I just want to hug that person and let them know that it's okay. And, thank goodness his mom still has him, but that's why we're doing this. We don't, as parents, our main thing that we always say together as a group is we don't want other parents to feel the pain we feel to lose their kids to such a senseless death. And if we save one child, we have done our job.
In about a minute, Judson Horace with the Interfraternity Conference has working with his parents. It cannot have changed you. Are you able to communicate how serious this is to the fraternities that you work with?
Well, it's been a life-changing experience to be involved with them, to find their courage and strength. It actually makes me really optimistic that we can solve this problem. And it's much bigger than I think people understand. It's in middle schools and high schools and everywhere, but they've given me strength and courage and optimism that we can get out of this. It's real. It's something that we all have got to pay attention to. And one of the powerful things the parents are doing is raising the awareness. I mean, simply being on public radio talking about these issues, there's probably going to be parents with kids in high school and middle school or in college who will be more aware just by this simple radio show. And my advice to you is if you sense something or feel something, say something. Tell the principal. Tell the teacher. Tell the administrators in college. You are an important part of helping us keep your sons and daughters safe.
There is an immunity for students who voluntarily report hazing incidents. That's part of this new law. I want to thank Judson Horace with the North American Interfraternity Conference, Elizabeth Allen with the University of Maine, Chris Quintana, he is a reporter at USA Today, and Debbie DeBrick. Thank you so much, member of the Anti-Hazing Coalition. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.